In a minute. Good morning again. The normal housekeeping issues of cell phones on off or buzz, and we will try and take a break about every 90 minutes. And once Dr. Jim gets a tutorial on running the program, we'll be off. Okay, I will turn it over to Jim Weinberg to give us an update on the Stock Assessment Workshop and Review Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jim Weinberg, and I'm at the Northeast Fisheries Science Center. I'm the Stock Assessment Workshop Chairman, and one of the roles that I play is after the SAWSARCs take place, I come to the Council to give a summary of the peer review. And it's important for you to understand that I didn't do the stock assessment, and I'm not one of the peer reviewers. I'm a messenger here. You can still shoot me, but okay. The SAWSARC that recently took place was number 54. And in the SAWSARC process, for some of the people who are new here, this is a process that we go through that's quite elaborate and a very thorough peer review. It starts out with working groups who get together and they meet several times for a period of maybe 6 months before the actual stock assessment is completed. And these working groups are open. They normally are comprised of scientists from the center as well as state scientists, people from universities, fishermen can participate on working groups in different ways in the process. There are data meetings and modeling meetings. And anyway, for the two stock assessments that I'll be telling you about, there were a series of these working group meetings held at the center. And then that's followed by a peer review, and independent peer reviewers are brought in to evaluate the work. And the people who do the stock assessment have no say in who the peer reviewers will be. The chairman of the peer review is a member of the SSC, and the other peer reviewers are appointed by the Center of Independent Experts. And we simply tell them what expertise the reviewers need to have, and then they select the peer reviewers, and they arrive in Woods Hole to do their job. The products that come out of these peer reviews, there are science reports as well as individual reports written by the peer reviewers and a summary report written by the peer review team. The management advice that's in these reports is limited. They are focused primarily on the stock assessment, although there is some information in there to give some guidance to the SSC when they try to recommend their ABC for each of the stocks. So in this particular case, the meeting that took place was for two stocks, Atlantic herring and Southern New England Mid-Atlantic Yellowtail Flounder. The meeting took place in June, and the peer review panel the panelists are listed on the left. The first stock that was reviewed was Atlantic herring. And this had been assessed previously in the TRAC process in 2009. And the conclusions from that were that the stock was not overfished, overfishing was not occurring. But this stock assessment had a serious retrospective pattern, which means that the data and the model did not fit each other very well. So there was a lot of uncertainty about this result. So for this stock assessment, I know the print here is very small. This is a list, and in addition, the following slide, these are the terms of reference that the stock assessment team had to analyze and present to the review panel. And these are basically developed from a generic set of terms of reference, and then we get external feedback through the NRCC from both councils and the ASMFC to develop the final terms of reference. And we go through this for each of our stock assessments that are done in the SAWSARC process. And in particular for this one, I just want to mention the third term of reference, which was singled out to specifically look at the utility of the fall acoustic survey to the stock assessment of herring. And I'll also point out number six, which explicitly asked the team to consider the implications of consumption of herring at various life stages and for use in estimating herring natural mortality rate and to inform the stock assessment, basically. So this number six was new because it was calling for the team to consider predator-prey interactions, the role of herring in the system as guidance toward figuring out what the true natural mortality rate should be that is assumed in the modeling. In the past, the consumption was reported, but it wasn't actually explicitly incorporated into the model, whereas, as you'll see in a moment, in this case, the consumption of herring played a major role in driving the results. And this is the second page of terms of reference. It calls for determining, doing the stock assessment and then figuring out what the stock status is based on the assessment and doing projections about what the stock should be doing in the future. And I'd like to give a lot of people were involved in doing this work. I'd like to give particular credit to John DeRoba, who was the lead assessment scientist on this stock assessment. So I'll first tell you some of the basic findings of the review panel, and then I'll show you the results. But by telling you the findings first, I'll let the cat out of the bag so that you know what the results are. So these are the major findings from the review panel. The new assessment model was accepted. They concluded that herring is not overfished and overfishing is not occurring. A key feature of the model is a 50% increase in natural mortality since 1996. And this is appropriate because it is consistent with the estimate of predation on herring, and it largely resolves the retrospective pattern that was present in the earlier model. High consumption of herring will likely continue in the immediate future, and this is important because when the panel was thinking about the biological reference points and the state of the stock and doing projections, they had to make an assumption about whether this high natural mortality rate would be here for a while or whether it would be gone next year. And they concluded that the high natural mortality rate that they've been seeing recently will continue during the next few years at least. The new biomass threshold and maximum sustainable yield are considerably less than the existing values of these reference points. And the new values were derived assuming a higher natural mortality rate and a more detailed stock assessment model. Now, a few more of their findings. A major source of uncertainty in the stock projections is the large size of the 2008 year class. This year class is predominant in the recent stock biomass increase and will be a significant component of projected yield in the immediate future. The next bullet, the survey indices that were included in the model were adequate. Acoustic survey data did not serve as an index of abundance in the model, was inconsistent with other indices, covered a limited area, and was not representative of the entire stock. And then the panel, in looking at how certain they were about the fit to the model, they had some questions about the level of uncertainty that was placed in the model related to the change in the trawl doors that took place in the 80s and the change in the survey vessels. So in general, then, the panel accepted this assessment. There was a big change in the assumed natural mortality rate, and the biological reference points changed a lot. Now, looking at some of the results, I'll focus on the lower right panel, which is the total total catch through time. And you can see that through time, in the early period, the catch was much higher in the 1960s, and it has been reduced somewhere in the neighborhood of 100,000 metric tons for the last 5 years or so. So there has been a big drop in the total catch over time. The way that has translated, now these are the results about the fishing mortality rate based on the stock assessment model. And you can see that when the catch was high back in the 70s, the fishing mortality rate was high. And since the mid-1980s and onward, when the catch has been reduced, the fishing mortality rate has also been reduced. So this makes sense. If you look at the catch data and the fishing mortality rate, they do line up. And I'd like to also point out that since the around 1995, the fishing mortality rate had been creeping up to the point where it had gone above the overfishing threshold. But it recently dropped, and the cause of that is that 2008 recruitment cohort that came into the population boosted the biomass, and by doing so, that lowered the fishing mortality rate. So at present, the overfishing is not occurring. Now, if we think about the biomass and the status about whether it's overfished or not, the conclusion is that the stock is not overfished. The trend in biomass over time has been that it was estimated to be high in the 60s. It fell to a low in the 1980s, climbed to about the mid-90s, and then was gradually declining until about 2010. And then with this pulse of recruits coming in, the biomass has increased significantly in the last year or so. And the current biomass is well above the overfished threshold. Now, I don't have time to go into it, but if we were really going into details, I'd mention that there have been a lot of changes to this stock assessment model since the track. And it's not just the change in M, but the assessment team made a lot of changes in the way the data were used. and felt that they really improved the way they used the available information. Now, I'd like to show, focus a little bit on that recruitment pulse. This is a plot of recruitment, age one individuals in the population, and you can see that that age one cohort in 2009 was a real boomer and is way above any of the historical values that have been seen in the time series. And a really important point to emphasize here is that in stock assessments, this, when we see large cohorts, and they're in the, like, among the most recent values in the time series, there's a lot of uncertainty about how they will actually play out into the fishery. And therefore, although the data indicate that these individuals are out there, it's a source of uncertainty going forward if they should have a real high mortality event or if they're not estimated with as much certainty as we think, that could be a much smaller value than is currently estimated. But at the moment, this is the best estimate of recruitment. Now, another important change in this stock assessment had to do with the assumed natural mortality rate. In the past, the assessment had assumed that the natural mortality rate was constant through time and that it was equal to 0.2. In this assessment, they looked at the mortality that was imposed on herring by predators, and that included not only fish, but they also took into account the whole gamut of predators, marine mammals, and seabirds, and highly migratory species. And when they looked at the catch, which is shown here, relative to the consumption by natural predators, the axis on the right shows the ratio of the consumption by natural predators to the catch taken by the fishery. And you can see that in the past, the ratio was down around close to one. But in recent years, there has been a real increase so that ratio of natural predators to the fishery is on the order of 3 or 4. And so it made sense in the model to assume that in 1996, the natural mortality rate went up, that there was a stanza in the early days when M was low, and then since 1996, M has been higher. And they considered how to incorporate this into the model, whether to have annual changes in M. But in the end, the approach that was taken was a more reasonable one, where they just broke it into two stanzas with two natural mortality rates assumed, one for the early period and another for the latter period. And when this was done, the retrospective pattern in the model was very much reduced. So not only did the model fit better, but there was empirical evidence for selecting the model that was selected. And when this was done, the biological reference points there was a big effect on the estimated biological reference points, and I've plotted them here in two columns. The ones that are under track 2009 are from the previous stock assessment, and the ones in the rightmost column are the currently estimated reference points. And the big changes, as you can see, are in, for instance, the spawning stock biomass at MSY, which is the biomass target. So it had been about 670,000 metric tons, now estimated to be about a fifth of that. And similarly, there are big reductions in the MSY value. The projections that were done, there are more of them in the documents, but I'll simply point out that with all of the projections, the stock is currently at a high biomass value at about over 500,000 metric tons. But in all of the projections that were done, the stock is predicted to decline. And just here are some of them showing if you were to fish at different levels of catch, what would happen. And just looking at the status quo catch, currently the catch is somewhere around 87,000 metric tons. And if that were to be continued into the future, looking down at the status quo catch for what that would do to spawning stock biomass, you can see that it would come down pretty rapidly towards the new SSB MSY. So there were some recommendations from the panel to, especially the one I'll mention, is that they need to monitor that recruitment event and follow it closely. And then there are some other ones that are less important that I'll skip over in the interest of time. Moving on to southern New England yellowtail. Again, there was a long list of terms of reference. And the panel findings are presented in the next two slides. First of all, the new assessment model was accepted, and they felt there was a good bridge built between the previous stock assessment and the current one. And a real key finding in this new assessment is that there's been a marked decline in recruitment since 1990. There were two recruitment scenarios developed to account for this, and neither of the two scenarios could be ruled out. So the SARC was in a situation where they developed two different hypotheses and they weighed the evidence for both of these scenarios, and they really couldn't rule out either one, although they slightly favored one of the scenarios, which had to do with a reduction in stock productivity. They looked at the oceanography data that was out there to see if there was like a smoking gun that could explain the reduction in stock productivity, but there was no real clear smoking gun to be found in the data that they examined. And so a source of uncertainty in this assessment remains that there's not a clear explanation for the factors affecting recruitment. The other findings were that the fishing mortality rate is relatively certain in this assessment, and they concluded that overfishing is not occurring. However, because they couldn't decide on a biomass target, there remains uncertainty as to whether or not the stock is overfished. And it depends on which of the two recruitment scenarios is adopted. And it makes a huge difference which one you choose. Under one of the scenarios, the stock is at an extremely low level relative to its target, not even close to being rebuilt. And under the other scenario, which just focuses on the recent recruitment data, you would conclude that the stock is at a very low level, but it's rebuilt to a level that's commensurate with its current productivity. So this was in the SARC, we try to get the reviewers to arrive at a conclusion that will provide a stock status determination. But in this case, even though we pushed them quite hard, they were unable to do it. So looking at some of the results from the assessment, this is a plot of the catch, and you can see here that in the around 1995, since then the catch has been very low, on the order of just hundreds of metric tons, compared to the historical catches, which were in the tens of thousands of metric tons. In this panel, it shows that the abundance over time has been reduced. And these are survey data from our spring survey and the center's fall survey. And the panels on the left show, the darker colors show high catches in the survey. Geographically, that's along the coast. And if you look at the panels on the right, those are the same locations, and those are plots of the survey catches that have been found recently. So you can see the colors are much lighter, and so the stock, compared to what it was in the 60s, is the abundance is greatly reduced based on the survey. This plot shows both the recruitment that has occurred through time and the spawning stock biomass. And I'll first mention the recruitment. Those are the vertical bars. And you can see that there were large recruitment events in the past. But for the last 20 years, since about 1992, all of the recruitments that have occurred have been well below average. And the biomass is the line here, and you can also see that there were some high biomass values in the past, but it went down and it has tracked at a fairly low level relative to the rest of the time series. So, this is in spite of the fact that the catches from the fishery have been estimated to be very low for quite some time. And usually when the catches are kept low, the stock responds by increasing. And only maybe in the last few years, if you're optimistic, you can see that line increasing. But I don't want to overinterpret low values. So in terms of overfishing, the conclusion is that overfishing is not currently occurring. And then I mentioned that when we consider biomass, there are two different scenarios. And one is called the recent recruitment scenario, and that also called a change in productivity. And the idea is that the stock is less productive now than it had been. And the other scenario is called the two-stanza scenario, and that considers the entire time series of recruitment. And in that one, it's more looking along the lines of when the stock biomass is high, one expects recruitment to be high because there are more spawners in the population. And when the biomass is very low, recruitment is low. So the second scenario is related more to tracking the size of the population, and that is a better predictor of how much recruitment you'll get. The first scenario is more of an environmental hypothesis, and it's saying that there's something that's changed in the environment that's affecting the fish, and that's causing them to have lower productivity, regardless of what the biomass is. So, and this is what I mentioned, neither scenario could be ruled out by the review panel. So we're in a situation where we have an overfished status according to the SARC results, which is unknown. This is a plot of showing the spawning stock biomass through time, and the yellow dot, which I've placed over the last data point here, shows that if you're using the recent recruitment scenario, it is above the target, which would indicate that the stock is currently rebuilt, but at a very low level. And if one were to use the two-stanza scenario, then the stock would be way below the rebuilding value and would still be declared it's not rebuilt, and it's not even close to being rebuilt. So two very different conclusions. And that's shown in this slide, which is a plot where the ratio of the current fishing mortality rate to the overfishing threshold is shown here. High values are bad because they indicate overfishing. And on this axis, on the x-axis, it's the spawning stock biomass that's estimated over the spawning stock biomass target. And here, high values are good because they indicate that the stock is high relative to its target. The value that's shown up here is the previous value from 2009, from the GARM assessment. And it was, at that time, overfishing was definitely occurring, and the stock was at a very low level of biomass. In this assessment, there's agreement that if you look at whether there's overfishing or not, the conclusion is consistent that it's below the overfishing value, which is good. But there's this two scenarios here, and depending on which of the scenarios is chosen, you get a very different picture of where the stock is relative to the target. So the panel had some recommendations. They felt that there should be, more evaluation of these two different scenarios, of course, to try to figure out which one is occurring. And then there were another set of recommendations. I think rather than go through each of these, I'll stop and open this up for questions or comments. But so that concludes my presentation.
Thank you, Jim. I am going to go to the audience first for comments or questions. And Mayor Mitchell had some comments.
Thank you for inviting me, Mr. Chairman. And by the way, the mint that you've left the witnesses is really a nice treat here. I appreciate that. It's not something I've ever encountered. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to the council. And what I hope to do today is to read a brief letter into the record, and each of you will get a copy of that letter. And then I'd like to just offer a couple of quick comments. And I appreciate your flexibility in affording me this opportunity. I know the schedule, Mr. Chairman, has been somewhat in flux, and I know you want to keep things on time. Yeah, as you know, on September 13, 2012, Commerce Secretary Rebecca Blank issued a fishery disaster determination for the Northeast multi-species groundfish fishery for the 2013 fishing year. The federal disaster determination was a direct result of a document released on August 2, 2012 by the council and NOAA that indicated that reductions ranging from 45% to 73% in FY 2013 ACLs for a number of stocks in the groundfish fishery were appropriate. As the mayor of New Bedford, Massachusetts, which was just named the nation's highest grossing fishing port for the 12th year in a row, I am extremely grateful for our congressional delegation and to Governor Patrick for pressing the Commerce Department to issue the disaster determination. At the same time, however, I strongly urge you, the council, to consider additional complementary policy responses that will forestall or mitigate the forecasted cuts in ACLs and help keep fishermen fishing. As you address proposed ACLs and other conservation measures in the coming days and weeks, I ask that you refrain from making decisions in which the reliability of the underlying science is in question. It is imperative that members have confidence in the scientific grounds for their decisions, given the potential deleterious economic and social consequences of those decisions. The economic and human stakes for New Bedford of your upcoming decisions cannot be overstated. Annual groundfish revenue in New Bedford is approximately $20 million. one species in the multi-species fishery, yellowtail flounder, is essential bycatch in New Bedford's scallop industry, which alone generates approximately $400 million in direct annual revenue. A conservative multiplier for these fisheries, which takes into account the economic activity of their shoreside businesses, is 3, conservatively speaking. Taken together, then, the groundfish and scallop fisheries account for nearly $1.3 billion in annual economic activity in New Bedford, which is roughly about 20% of GDP for the greater New Bedford area. Given these numbers, even if Congress appropriates $100 million in aid for the New England groundfish fishery, the forecasted cuts would assuredly deal a devastating blow to New Bedford and permanently eliminate hundreds, if not thousands, of jobs in the southeastern part of the state. The cuts would also likely trigger severe social dislocation, with fishing families losing their income streams and even their homes. The New Bedford fishing community wants to survive, as do the fishing communities elsewhere in New England. To a person, all of the fishermen with whom I have spoken have said they do not want handouts. They want to continue fishing. The forecasted cuts and their consequences would be painful enough for New Bedford's fishing community if the underlying science was beyond debate. But they are unacceptable in light of the growing lack of confidence in stock assessments, both among fishermen and scientists. Adding to that uncertainty and the lack of confidence, fishermen have repeatedly told the federal government, thus far to little avail, that the underlying surveys are conducted with the wrong types of vessels and gear and are therefore inherently inaccurate. Over the summer, scientists raised serious questions about the model used for Georgia's Tank yellowtail for the yellowtail flounder sock assessment. Months earlier, the 2011 Gulf of Maine cod assessment, which showed a dramatic negative change from the 2008 assessment, with which you are all familiar, was called into question. And when the 2011 groundfish stock assessment updates were conducted, significant unexplained discrepancies ranging from 19% to 67% deviations in the estimate of stock biomass were noted for 7 stocks, all of which you are familiar with, ranging from Gulf of Maine, yellowtail, the Georges Bank cod, as well as others. In my mind, these examples should give serious pause to the range of decision-making on ACLs contemplated by the Council. I was pleased to see that at its August 24th meeting, the SSC discussed the concerns with Georges Bank yellowtail flounder model, with the model itself, and decided to recommend a range of catch options up to 1,150 metric tons, which is the current FY 2012 catch limit for yellowtail. By including this upper range of 1,150 metric tons for FY 2013, the SSC recognized the prudence of proceeding cautiously in the face of uncertainty in the underlying model and its impact on decisions of its decisions on fishing communities. In sum, I ask that you keep the economic and social ramifications at the forefront of your discussions, as is your charge under Magnuson-Stevens, and that you consider whether proposed measures that curb fishing are justified by the science. I also ask for your support of measures that would mitigate the consequences of any reduced ACLs. If the fisheries in New Bedford are shut down, they will not come back. The barriers to entry are simply too high, and foreign sellers who already supply 91% of our nation's seafood will fill the void. On behalf of the fishermen, their families, and the nearly 100,000 residents of the city of New Bedford who have a stake in your actions, I ask that you do all you can to keep New Bedford's fishermen fishing. Just one brief comment in the way of emphasis, if nothing else. There has been a great deal of publicity around the disaster declaration and the proposed appropriation of roughly $100 million to assist fishermen and their families and fishing communities like New Bedford. And I think that's all to the good, and there's no disputing that from where I sit. But there is a risk inherent in the declaration, and that's this. It's not the end of the story. We continue to have the same problem with proposed dramatic cuts that will put folks out of work, and based on science that many reputable scientists consider to be dubious. It is the disaster declaration and the aid associated with it are often couched in terms that make it seem like disaster relief for the family farm, right? So this Congress for many years has been in the business of bailing out farmers in the Midwest, many family farms in the Midwest especially. And so there are folks, including people in high positions, who suggest this is all we're doing. We're taking care of the fishermen, and they will be all set. We just need to, you know, throw a little money their way. There is an inherent problem in that logic, and it's this. Farmers get to continue to farm even after they receive disaster relief. Not so with fishermen. As you all know, there is sort of, remember the old grocery stores, not so old grocery stores, they had the indoor and the outdoor. In the fishing industry, there's only the outdoor. Once people leave the industry, the reality is that they remain out of it, especially if they're boat owners. They move on. And we've seen this trend over time with people, especially in communities like New Bedford and Gloucester and others, where families who have been in the business for generations get out, and they stay out. That is just one reality of living in a fishing community and being in the fishing industry. So your decisions in that respect are permanent. And the reality is, too, that you can't unring the bell. Once they're out by and large. And so all the more reason to tread lightly, especially in the face of science that, even as I listened to the presentation this morning, is highly uncertain. There is no consensus, not even something close to a consensus, and the best available science is hardly the kind of science that we would make these kinds of momentous decisions on. Don't get me wrong. I get it. Your decision is not your decisions respecting groundfish ACLs are not easy. They are not easy decisions. But one of your charges, as I said earlier, is to consider the social and economic impact of your decisions on fishermen and the communities in which they live. And I'm here to tell you that the time is now to tread lightly, to not, especially in the face of science that has problems, and because once you've made your decisions, they're permanent. Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the time.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Anyone else? Judd.
Judd Crawford, Pew Environment Group. I have two, I hope, quick questions for Dr. Weinberg about the herring part of the stock assessment. We all, I think, know in this room that Atlantic herring are probably the most important forage species we have in the region. They're eaten by groundfish and tuna and all kinds of other things, including whales. And the data that you reviewed and that the Stock Assessment Committee and peer review team looked at that had to do with consumption showed, if you look at it through a coarse filter, a sort of a long-term steady upward trajectory, almost exponential, if you smooth that through, in consumption by predators. And I guess one question is whether, if we're successful in rebuilding groundfish and other stocks that are down from where we'd like to see them, for which we have programs in place, would we expect that the consumption would continue to rise on into the future? It would seem probable that it would, but I wondered if there was anything to be said about that from the stock assessment team and peer review. And the second question I have, I'll ask them and then leave you to respond. Is you also talked about a number, you talked about several catch scenarios that the stock assessment team and peer review committee looked at. You talked about two of them. There are a number of them in the stock assessment report. The SSC memo that was released yesterday talks about a constant catch scenario of 114,000 metric tons over the next coming 3 years. I wonder if that's one of the ones that was considered by the stock assessment team and the SARC peer review panel. So if those are my two questions on the stock assessment. Thanks.
Thanks. I think the first question is one that's a complicated. It's not easy to answer that question because it would require making lots of assumptions about what different species are doing, and of course you know that they play different roles in the ecosystem, and so not all fish are alike. And of course there's the concern that a lot of people are aware of, if many different species come up near carrying capacity, what that will do. And of course then a lot of ecological interactions come into play, competition for resources and changes in distribution and so forth. So it's very difficult to answer your question specifically, but I think that going back to what the review panel concluded, they concluded that the high consumption that they're seeing currently is likely to continue in the future. And I don't think they were able to make it any more quantitative than that. Regarding the other question, I think that's getting into what the SSC has done, and I don't, off the top of my head, I'm not prepared to answer the question to compare what was done in the assessment relative to what projections have been done subsequently. It might be there, but I'm not sure.
Okay. Thank you.
Ron?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ron Smolitz, Fisheries Survival Fund. I wonder if Dr. Jim could put up the yellowtail slide with the recruitment time series. Well, that one's fine. What happened in the years of low yellowtail? What's the status of the biomass of dogfish and skates?
Well, again, I don't have the data in front of me, but I think you're looking for a particular answer, so maybe you would like to tell us.
This is the same point I made last winter, is that we need a major research effort to understand. I mean, just like Dave Goethe pointed out last night, we're not single species management anymore. We need to be examining the competing species, I mean, the ones that eat the same prey and the predator-prey relationships, to try to understand what is happening. We're not going to understand it with a bunch of modelers in a room. So that's point one. I mean, I keep on saying that, but nothing is happening. And we're not going to make any progress until we understand that we need to be putting a lot more fishing effort onto dogfish and skates. So that's point one. Point two, which is I'm starting to get a little bit disturbed about, is the concept that the NIMS survey is no good because the gear is no good. We need to be doing side-by-sides. Been there, done that. The 40 years that I've been working on this, in the early 70s, when I was doing the gear work down at the Science Center, we were bringing on the URI 41 high-rise. When we changed the doors on a Yankee 36, the survey, we did side-by-sides. They don't answer the questions. I went and I looked at the 2011 survey on Georges Bank in the spring, compared it to stations that I had, and my personal view is the Bigelow is doing a fine job getting a representative sample of yellowtail. The problem is it's not doing enough stations. It's never done enough stations. In 40 years, time and time again, from McNaff years on, that's always been the problem. You cannot set quotas with the NIMS survey. It's inadequate. I would suggest that the Science Center find a couple of industry boats that could tow the same gear, and in the spring survey, get two more industry boats out there with scientific parties and triple the number of stations in the areas where you have yellowtail, both southern New England and Georgia's Bank. And if you want to, go where you had the cod issues as well, and triple your stations and see how that impacts your accuracy and precision. What I see happening with yellowtail is that they're densing up. So it's a moving target. I could go to spots and get the same catch rates that I got 10 years ago and 15 years ago in my gear research, but it's harder to find those spots. So there's a difference in the distribution of the fish, and when you have a survey that has a very small number of stations, that's when you're going to have a lot of zeros and a few big hits, like we saw in the Canadian survey. There's other problems going on out there also with the larger yellowtail, with food availability, things like that, and certainly water temperature. What we learned in the scallop fishery, when we were going to area management, we needed more surveys. So we built up the RSA program. We have a significant amount of surveys. Right now, we have two scallop vessels out to sea today, the Liberty and the Celtic, with scientific parties from SMAS, VIMS, and Sea Farm Foundation on board, doing comparison fishing of gear on our standard set of grid surveys for our bycatch project. That's the type of work that needs to be done in the ground fishery. NIMS needs to take a lead and get some industry boats out there and get a lot more stations occupied. It's the side-by-side comparisons or attacking the Bigelow gear is not the solution here.
Peter Shelley. Peter Shelley, Conservation Law Foundation. Mr. Chair, members of the Council, this is yet another extraordinarily discouraging assessment result on an important stock of fish. The way I look at the two scenarios, one basically is taking management off the table. There's nothing you can do because the environment, whether it's dogfish skates, pollution, sea temperature, who knows, is controlling the population and recruitment, and there's nothing you can do that's going to change that. The other scenario suggests that there are some management actions you could take that would help restore the stock. I'm not a scientist, but I suspect that the actual situation is somewhere in the middle, that there are environmental factors out there that are influencing this, and certainly the issues that Ron identified are very important to think about. But I also think there's some management actions. And, this is sort of a classic Hobson choice between these two scenarios. You either have a choice in which it's no longer overfished, but guess what? There's never going to be southern mid-Atlantic yellowtail available to support fishing families or ports. The other one is that you're heavily overfished and you've got a long way to go to recover, and that you've got to take management actions that some of you don't seem willing to take. The second point I wanted to make from this is no matter which scenario, you are left with at least the best science advice at this point, which is you don't have many fish out there of the southern yellowtail flounder. And so the management action you can't duck is how are you going to allocate those fish? Yesterday, many of you were talking about the socio-cultural impacts of your decisions, and this is one of them. Who gets those scarce yellowtail, whether they're constrained by the environment or management failure up to this point? Who's going to get them? Which group of fishermen are most dependent on these fish? And is this a bycatch fishery for scallopers? Is this something that will support inshore boats and small ports? That's a management action that you shouldn't duck. And from my perspective, you can't duck. Thank you. Jeff.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, members of the council. I'm going to read this thing. I'm Jeff Kalin with from Lund's Fisheries in Cape May, New Jersey. We've got about a dozen boats and 75 full-time people and a couple hundred people when our plant's operating. And I wanted to make a comment following up on Judge's questions on herring, specifically on the constant catch scenario, which you'll hear about in a few minutes from the SSC report. And it's, we went to the working group meetings. I spent 2 or 3 weeks in Woods Hole during the herring assessment, and I really appreciate Dr. Weinberg and the other people at the centers allowing us to participate. We weren't at the table. We're not scientists. Judd was at the table. I think Steve Cadron was there for choir. So the issue's got a full vetting. But, in fact, there were no constant catch scenarios that came out of the workshop recommendations. You'll see there was an FNMSY estimate, and that was about 165,000 tons potentially in FY or fishing year 2013. And then the PDT met, and they went back with a recommendation of the SSC to do 75% of MSY approach, and that would go down to about 135 or something in 2013. And we asked at the PDT whether or not, what would be a constant catch approach so that we could have some predictability over the next 3 years in the herring fishery. And we were told initially that you had to take the lowest of the 3 years, in other words, the 2015 value, and fish that for 3 years. And frankly, that didn't really make any sense to me. And John DeRoba, who was the lead scientist during the assessment, took this seriously and went back and cranked out a constant catch scenario that gives us the same yields over the next 3 years. So it didn't happen during the assessment. It happened during the PDT and the SSC meetings where this approach was developed. And the result is, if this is where the council decides to go, we're going to leave 30 or 40,000 metric tons in the water in addition to a 25% buffer if we take 75% of MSY. So these yields are very conservative, we believe, and I think that's really how this evolved. And I wanted to just mention that to the council before you heard from Chris later. Thank you.
Anyone else in the audience?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the council. With respect to the herring, we've come out with what I regard is a very low biomass figure based on my experience. Now, my experience is primarily, my name is Owen Rochford from Norpell. I fished most of my life until I took this job. I fished on the east and west side of the Atlantic. I fished the Pacific and the Bering Sea. And even though I have a lot of faith in fishermen able to catch fish, they can't catch what isn't there. And to say that they can catch, 20% of the biomass, I think, is farcical, particularly with the fleet of boats we have here. I think that the biomass, because the data that they put in, they match their mathematical model, which is fine. I credit the guys with their nice structured mathematical model. But my problem is, my feeling is, like, there's about four times as much fish out there, because when they tried to do an acoustical survey, they considered it noise. Well, as a fisherman, when we see noise on the sounder, believe it or not, that's fish. So I'm very, very worried about how they're collecting the data. When they do the spring and fall surveys, they use a bottom trawl to do it. Herring are a midwater fish, and it's like the scenario I put it like, it's like a blind squirrel finding an acorn from time to time. So these data points, like pinning the tail on the donkey when you look at the graph, the way it comes out. And, the general public, or the donkey in this case, unfortunately, I have no faith at all in the data that went into these mathematical models. The same thing holds true when you look at the yellowtail. I mean, how can fishermen catch what isn't there? Realistically, it's impossible. Like, they can't. If a fishery is in decline and the fish are being overfished, basically, well, the chances of a fisherman catching them in the net are slim to nil. And they never seem to take that into account. The practical aspects are, when you're scalloping, you're catching scallops, and the gear is set to catch scallops. It's not set to catch yellowtail, which is a bycatch. But how can they catch more fish than what the council say is in the water? I mean, the data has to be flawed. I mean, unless we kind of relook at this again, the whole lot of the fishing community is going to be out of business. In the last 2 years alone, from the unyielding nature and a haddock bycatch, we've lost 6 boats, and I haven't had a fish go through the plant since the start of July as a result of boats being lost to the herring fishery. They've no faith anymore, like, in what's going on. The management structure is broken, guys. And it needs to be fixed. You need to analyse what you're doing, the sanctions placed on boats, how the science is used to analyse the biomass out there. Because my attitude as a commercial fisherman looking in from the outside, the system is totally broken. I mean, looking at the data, there shouldn't be any way in hell of catching a fish out in the ocean the way the data is coming out. Yet every time a fishing boat goes out, it can come back with oodles of fish, and the bycatch is what's going to kill it. Because obviously the figures are wrong, because the bycatch, again, is significant of the amount of fish in the ocean. So if you take it that a guy catches bycatch, you count that bycatch up. I mean, how can he catch more bycatch than the council says out in the ocean in the first place? It doesn't make any sense to me. Please review these figures very carefully before you start whacking quotas, because we won't have a fishing community left. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to bring it back to the council for a couple of comments, and then I think if we move it on to the SSC, we're going to get perhaps a repeat of some of them. Dave?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Of the comments I've heard, I think that Ron has hit it pretty much on the head. And I particularly was pleased that he expanded upon what Dave Gaithel said yesterday. I was going to do so yesterday, but Dave expressed himself so well that I didn't. But we discussed this at length last night. Mark Gibson was involved in the discussion. And it's inescapable that right now we've got a food web that is thoroughly distorted. The distortion, we may not have overfishing occurring at this time, but the distortion is the result of past overfishing decades ago. And now what we have is low abundance and productivity of desirable species, but that new paradigm has become stable, and it's devilishly hard to change it. The stability is being maintained through a series of feedback loops that seem to center upon the spiny dogfish as being this key character, the key player in maintaining a much different paradigm than what we need to manage for. We're going to continue with low productivity and with a low abundance of species that are desirable as long as we allow this feedback loop to produce that kind of stability. I think that what we need to do is be looking at breaking that paradigm, that stability, that feedback loop. We may have to actually overfish dogfish in order to take them out of the equation to allow this to happen. And then at that point, we need to be ready to combine our management plans. We're going in too many directions at once. We're not making any progress because we're wrapped up with this single species management that's occupying all of our time and going nowhere. And as Dave mentioned yesterday, it's been going nowhere for 4 decades. And we've got to get these plans combined into one ecosystem-based management plan so we can get some kind of efficiency in what we do. And at that point, then perhaps we can, instead of being like somebody who's trying to develop a shopping center in an undeveloped area and having to do an EIS for the pine trees and one for the maple trees and one for the bugs and one for the birds, we can just do an ecosystem management plan that we update with one action and not get wrapped up in what we're doing. One of the things that I really like what's happening right now is this, it's become evident that we've got at least three plans, the scallop, the groundfish, and the habitat plan that now have to work together, being forced to work together. We should have been doing that a long time ago. But we need to place this in some kind of a more rational and coordinated plan. Mark has a lot of good information on that that he brought up yesterday afternoon, and I don't know if he wants to expand upon that. He knows a lot more about the bioenergetics of it than I do, but I don't see how we can continue as David was saying yesterday, doing the same thing, expecting a different outcome. Thank you.
Mark, did you have a follow up on that?
I could have been. Good thing I was pulling up that paper while Dave was talking. I'll just read a statement out of a paper by Jeremy Colley and John Steele. An increase in cod within the piscivore guild would require decreases in other piscivores, such as the Elasma rex, winter skater, spiny dogfish. And the science is already there in terms of, it's already saying what we're hearing, that there'll have to be active restructuring of the community out there in order for it to return to its cod contaminated food web. So I think the information is already available. It's a legal problem. You can't deliberately overfish components of the ecosystem to get to the desired end.
Bill Karp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a few comments in response to the various comments that I've heard. The first is clearly, and I regret that I wasn't here yesterday because a lot of this discussion certainly took place then. Clearly, the council is faced with some very difficult challenges, and that the issues before the council are severely affecting the livelihood of the fishing communities in a way that is perhaps unprecedented. Furthermore, the information that's coming forward, these decisions are being based on science. And so from the science center and from the science community, we're bringing the news, which is unwelcome news, and we understand that. I continue to stand behind the integrity of the science, and I believe that all of the evaluations of the science support that perspective. Nevertheless, the science is uncertain, and there is an extra burden of proof on us from the science side to explain and to communicate what it is that we are doing and how we're doing it and what are the sources of uncertainty and how we might proceed to address those sources of uncertainty. And I think John mentioned yesterday that we're planning to have a forum in November, which will be the first step in addressing this broad challenge of better communicating our science to everybody who's interested and of listening to all of you and whoever chooses to attend this forum to help us to figure out how to do a better job of communicating and of listening. So that's the first thing that I really wanted to say to you. With response to this particular discussion, a couple of things I think are important. One is the discussion that Ron started and then Dave and Mark engaged in relative to the factors within the ecosystem that are changing and what action we might be able to take to recognize that in some kind of active management. There's no question that we need to look at this from an ecosystem perspective, and that the center and the region and the council are engaging in that process, although it's moving inexorably slowly, partially because of the demands that are placed on all of us to look at these single species assessments and provide advice in that manner. But you can see, an example of how that played out in the herring assessment, where we were able to look at a broader range of ecosystem factors and take those into account in looking at the various factors that will affect natural mortality and incorporating that in the assessment. So there's an example of a small step in that direction. I caution all of us to be mindful that the outcome of this process may not be what we think it's going to be. There's no question that there's a very high abundance of Elasma branx in the system now, and that there's legitimate concerns and a legitimate perspective that if we manage that part of the fish community in a particular way, there'll be a clear cause and effect, if you will, in terms of recovery of the groundfish stocks. we need to look at that very carefully, and we are doing some work in that regard. And I'm going to ask Jason Link to come and talk to the council at some point soon about what he has been doing. But it's a much more complex issue than it first appears to be, and that's part of the challenge of how to deal with that broader perspective. It doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. It does mean that we need to be very mindful of where we're going and how we're stepping in that direction. The second thing that Ron raised was the survey question, and I'm grateful to Ron for clarifying at least his perspective on the value of the Bigelow surveys and the quality of the data that comes from the surveys. Because in my view, at least coming from another part of the country and seeing how things played out there, in the Northeast, a huge amount of work was done between the agency and the industry to develop the new survey gear and to match that with the Bigelow. That the outreach was huge, and the recognition of input from the fishers and from the gear manufacturers was unprecedented. That doesn't mean that this survey is not without its challenges and that there are places where we could make things better. And we have been looking at how best to move forward and partner with the industry with some kind of industry-based survey, whether it's called a side-by-side survey, whether it's called a supplementary survey of some kind, which would require some intercalibration. And this idea of working with the industry to look at the feasibility of an industry-based survey for flatfish is one of several candidate ideas that we have on the table and that we're looking at. So I will be coming back to the council and sharing our perspective as these ideas develop and seeking input from the council and from the industry on that particular aspect. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Bill. I have Tom Dempsey, then Doug Grout. Then we are going to take a break and come back and get the SSC presentation. Tom.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I guess in light of this ecosystem discussion, and I think it's a good one, anybody wants to talk about what we should do with dogfish and how we can rebalance the ecosystem, I'm very happy to have that conversation. But in light of the ecosystem approach, I want to maybe take a second crack at answering the earlier question on the consumption model that was brought up. And I think the simple answer is yes. If we rebuild groundfish, they have to eat something, and they'll be eating herring. So we can expect consumption. In the event that we ever do rebuild these groundfish stocks, we can expect consumption to go up. And I take Jim's point. It's very complicated. This eats that. That eats this. But ultimately, it all comes back down to the forage base. So I think those consumption models can be expected to go up. And I think the flip side of that is I don't think we can rebuild groundfish, some of these depleted groundfish stocks, without something, without forage for them to consume. So I think there is a tight ecosystem-based link that we're already seeing here. If we rebuild these groundfish stocks, the simple answer is consumption is going to go up. So maybe that's an oversimplified approach, but I think that's the nut of what we're talking about in terms of some of these ecosystem interactions. Leads me to a second question, and we heard yesterday about the acoustic survey taking a year off. And I'd sort of like to get, Jim, your thoughts on where we are with the acoustic survey. So my understanding, it was an approach or an augmented approach, supplemental approach that everyone from the industry to management, stock assessment scientists recognize that because of the nature of the pelagic nature of this stock, an acoustic survey should better allow us to estimate. Now, having sat at some of those data meetings, the acoustic survey shows some pretty troubling trends on Georges for this stock. For their own reasons, this was sort of taken out, I think primarily because it didn't agree with the underlying model or the results of the underlying model that was used. This was taken out of the assessment and run as a sensitivity analysis. But I guess I wonder if where are we going with the acoustic survey? Everybody wanted it. It was going to happen. We ran it. We didn't like the answer. Didn't jive with this model that admittedly is dependent on a 2008 year class, and now we're taking a year off. So could you explain where we are with that tool, why it wasn't used this go-around, and whether we're essentially scrapping the program?
I see Bill's hand up.
Bill has his hand up. I could say something. Bill, do you want to speak first? Or?
Why don't you start?
Okay. I didn't sit in on all of the working group meetings, so I don't know the exact details of the acoustic survey and its fit in terms of, you know, the rest of the surveys and so forth. But the working group took a close look at this, and there were questions about the initial, I think it was the early time points in the acoustic survey were very high, and then there was a large drop that stayed fairly consistently low relative to those two initial high points. And I don't think that made any sense relative to any of the other information that was out there. And when I think that, you know, that's my kind of shallow understanding of this. As I said, I wasn't on the working group. And in general, acoustic surveys should work, and I think in other parts of the world they are being used to assess species such as herring. So I know people are scratching their heads, why isn't it working in our system? And there were questions raised about whether the stock of herring, the herring survey is not conducted over the entire range of the stock assessment. So there's always the question of whether the fish have moved or not, because if you always do the survey in one place and the fish are moving in and out, then that would cause the survey not to make sense over time. So they examined that, and I don't think they found evidence of any big changes in the migration. So that didn't explain it away. And but I know that people, you know, are trying to understand why it isn't working. And it had something to do with the spatial scale of the survey relative to the fish population and this real lack of fit in those initial time points. Now, I believe Bill would be able to add to that, as he has quite a bit of experience with acoustic surveys and so forth.
Thank you, Jim and Tom. It's true that I've worked with acoustics and the acoustic assessments of pollock in the Bering Sea, and I have a general knowledge of how well acoustics works in various parts of the world, for herring amongst other species. So I'm equally concerned. I think it's a powerful tool, and I think we need to figure out how to make it work. There are probably some problems with survey design and timing. I haven't had the opportunity personally to look at this very carefully. One of the reasons for suspending the survey in 2014 is to actually give us enough time to look very carefully at how we're doing this and what the shortcomings might be so that we can improve the design for future years. So this suspension of the survey should not be seen as a cancellation. It should be seen really as a need just to take a time out so that we can figure out how to make it work better.
Craig?
Just a quick follow-up. Are we defining the acoustic survey working as matching the signal that's coming out of the model? I mean, it seems like had the acoustic survey demonstrated the upward trend over the last few years that the model projects, that it would be adopted and included. What's the definition of the acoustic survey working? The acoustic survey worked. It demonstrated a signal that happens not to jive with the model. And so what we're looking for out of this this powerful new technology is for it to essentially support or duplicate something that we're already doing, and if it provides a different signal, then it's clearly not working. That wasn't my understanding with where we were going with the acoustic survey.
Let me try and respond. There are obviously a number of different sources of data that inform the model. And so if one of those sources is an outlier, it's particularly difficult to reconcile. But that's by itself not a reason to throw it out. It's a reason to look more carefully at what it's telling us. And that may be part of the problem, that we're not looking carefully enough. For example, and hopping back to pollock, which is a very different animal, the bottom trawl survey and the acoustic survey different parts of the population structure, different sizes and ages. and I don't know, again, being new to how this has been done here, to what extent that's true with the pelagic versus demersal surveys here and how that's taken into account. But it's an example of the kinds of things that we would want to look at to not look for a match per se in biomass estimates, but to look to see exactly what kind of information this is providing and how it can be included in the assessment.
Doug Grout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a piece of information I might be able to provide to Tom, and then I had a question for Dr. Jim about a particular part of the assessment. But when we've received these the assessment, both at ASMSC via the section and then at the committee, one of the questions that we provided asked was about this 2008 year class and whether they were whether it was being picked up every place, because there was some rather large year class. And the response that we've gotten from the assessment biologists was that it is picked up very clearly and strongly in the multiple trawl surveys that were analyzed in the assessment and put into the model, as well as the catch at age. But it was not picked up in the acoustic survey. And so that was one of the reasons that I think they were reluctant to use it in the assessment, because it was showing up in so many that year class was showing up in so many of the different pieces of data, but not in that. Why it is, I don't know, and that's, I think, that's a good task for the Science Center. The question I had for Jim was with our new estimate of maximum sustainable yield. I understand why it declined so much, and it makes total sense if you can bring that up to me. The increased M clearly is driving that, as well as you said, the new model. It makes total sense to me as a scientist, at least a former one. But the thing that struck me, and I think this was brought up at one of our meetings here, is that we now have a estimate of the current maximum sustainable yield that's significantly below even our most recent long-term average since the 80s, and clearly way below our average catches if you go through the entire landing series. And, you know, my recollection from school that maximum sustainable yield was a long-term equilibrium. But it surprises me that we can have catches consistently over a 40-year time series that exceed the current value, and so I was of MSY. And so I was wondering if either the assessment scientists or the peer review scientists or even yourself might be able to enlighten me and the rest of the council as to how we can be continually harvesting over maximum sustainable yield and still not have a resource that's overfished and overfishing isn't occurring.
Yeah, I fortunately, not because I'm smart, but John DeRoba had the foresight to provide me with some answers that this would come up. And his explanation was that this is largely driven by the current herring growth rate and the natural mortality rate. The growth rate is lower now, and the fish have smaller weight per size, weight per age, and the natural mortality rate is higher. So the MSY that currently exists is consistent with the new perception of the fish, as he calls it, being skinnier and dying faster. And that leads to the lower MSY value that has come out. And if you look at the biomass trends anyway that were occurring since the mid-90s, the biomass had been declining for about 10 years until this recent pulse of recruitment. So, in fact, the stock biomass had been declining, and that was something I remember the SARC panel talking about. So they did consider this in their evaluation. And just to correct one point about the acoustic survey that I think you made incorrectly, John indicated that the acoustic survey did pick up an indication of the 2008 year class.
That's not what I heard.
Right. Okay.
We were going to go to a break now. Dave, you got a quick question?
Yeah, I just had two quick ones. One on slide 17 on the herring. I don't see any discussion of the mixing rate. We're now fully harvesting the fish in Area 2, so the mixing rate is pretty important. And I was just wondering if the assessment didn't discuss that or if the SSC is going to deal with it. And that's bullet 3 on that slide.
Yeah, I think that there wasn't a whole lot of focus on this during the stock assessment, and they were, at least what I heard, they were looking more in terms of the work that was presented to them, which was for the entire stock. And I know that the way the assessment is done does not match the way you manage herring, which where you have these sub-areas and allocations and so forth. And I think they viewed that more as at the next stage when the council gets to it, those discussions will occur. But they didn't really get into that in detail, in any detail.
Okay. My second one is on yellowtail, slide 23. And I just wanted to point out to people, if you look at the time period around 1951 to 1956, 57, this was a similar period with a very warm water regime. And then you go look at the 2000s. And, I mean, to me, this is your smoking gun for southern New England yellowtail flounder. Remember, in the 1950s, there were essentially no fishing restrictions of any kind. The catch dropped to levels, very, very low levels, presumably with people actively fishing for whatever they could catch. In the 2000s, they've been actively constrained by fisheries management to low levels. But the two numbers look very similar. So I think going forward here, at least with yellowtail, one of the things we're going to have to start doing is comparing warm water regimes and cold water regimes and looking for what our biomass reference point should be under two different scenarios. Because clearly in the 1950s, this stock dropped to a very, very low level. And, you know, it's the same regime. So, you know, I'm grateful for this slide being in here because it illustrates the issue with southern New England yellowtail, and I imagine with Georges Bank yellowtail very nicely. So I didn't know if you wanted to comment on that or not.
No, I'm not prepared to comment on that. And out of fairness, I had mentioned John DeRoba doing a lot of work on herring. I just want to acknowledge Larry Alade was the lead assessment scientist on the flounder assessment, also did an excellent job.
Thank you, Jim. We'll take a 10-minute break. We'll come back at 10:10, and we will get into the SSC report.